guys. Welcome back to another episode of So OCD. Thank you so much for joining me today, and thank you to everyone who made the launch of this show such a success last week. I heard from so many of you how listening and hearing just a bit of my story made you feel less alone, and I can't tell you how much that means to me. That's exactly why I started this podcast, and to know I played a small role in making your own struggles feel a little bit more manageable makes it completely worth the time, energy, and vulnerability it takes to produce So OCD. Today's episode is going to be a little different from the last. Today, I'm sharing my own personal OCD story in a way I never have before. There's so much, of course, that I won't be able to include because I think you guys like the shorter format, but I'm excited to bring you along on this particular journey with me. So thanks again for being here, and let's get started. The morning sun was hot on my skin, baking me in my bed. But it was summer, and I wasn't about to move just yet. My mother came in to kiss me goodbye before leaving for work, and I realized it was still early enough to sleep a bit longer. So I did. And then I dreamed, too. It was the kind of dream that isn't quite bad, but definitely sticks around. It swirled in my head for a few hours after I woke up, and I felt unsettled. The dream made me feel off, like something was wrong, and my thoughts were prowling through my head like a lion in search of prey. After a morning of errands, I returned to my mother's house where I had been living since I graduated college to do a whole lot of nothing. I hadn't yet found a job, I was back in my hometown where I didn't really want to be, and most of my days were spent babysitting my little sister and applying for work online. But I still had hope. Not enough time had passed for me to feel completely discouraged. Still, that morning was different. Months of being hours away from my boyfriend, now husband, and the university where I had found so much life and purpose was quietly beginning to take its toll. And looking back, it seems like my brain knew this long before I was conscious of it. I wandered around the house, bored, barely noticing the natural beauty of my surroundings. My mother had built this home my junior year of high school, and we had moved in just as I began 12th grade. It sat back from the road at the end of a long driveway, nestled in a dense green wood with a beautiful creek down below the covered porch. It held many wonderful memories for me, but on that morning it was too quiet, too isolated. And the lion was prowling. As I sat down to watch a documentary on the sinking of the Bismarck, it finally located its prey, and it pounced. It was my very first intrusive thought, at least the first one I can remember ever being sent into a panic over. And it was so contrary to who I was and what I believed about goodness and truth that it sent me into a tailspin. I hopped up from my seat, utterly panic-stricken, and began pacing all over the house, muttering to myself, eyes wide with fear and confusion, and trying to find a way out of my own skin, my own mind. But once that thought took root, there was no going back. This was the beginning of my OCD. The debate continues as to whether OCD is primarily a biological condition, an environmental one, or a combination of the two. I can't say for certain, but what I do know is that the conditions and circumstances of my first intrusive thought were ideal for OCD to grow in a way it never had before. I had gone from a very busy season of life, full of dreams and work and play, to a much more isolated and restless existence. I was growing depressed and unsure of my future, which up until that summer had always seemed so simple, so secure. And I'd had a bad dream. Life itself was not bad, but it didn't look anything like what I had expected anymore. And months of that feeling combined with a lonely morning and an unsettling dream formed a cocktail that fairly exploded in my face. For months after that, I kept track of every intrusive thought I had. I would write them down, abbreviated, of course, because I couldn't take the risk of someone finding my notes and thinking I was insane or evil or both, and reviewed them over and over again. I sat on my purple love seat each night, staring at the clear summer sky and whispering tearful, urgent prayers for God to heal me. I analyzed every single thought in order to reassure myself that no, I would never do that, and no, that hadn't happened, no matter how vivid the image. All I ever tried to do in life was to make good and kind decisions, and my brain had betrayed me into thinking that it was all a lie, that I was a lie. I was acting out compulsions without even knowing what they were. I kept my list. I ruminated and obsessed over every tiny detail of my day. I avoided situations that had once brought me joy to keep my intrusive thoughts at bay. Outwardly, things weren't perfect. I was only working a few hours a week at a job I hated. I was fighting constantly with my mother, and I missed my college crew desperately, especially my boyfriend. My saving graces were my childhood friends and my sisters. No one actually knew how I felt or quite how miserable I was. I kept that between me and God. But I was lucky to have them around. I still remained on the outside, largely the Wendy I had always seemed to be. Happy, confident, ambitious. But my internal world was completely unraveling and I didn't know how to stop it. Finally, I moved into my dad's house that spring and began seriously going after full-time positions in my field, desperate to begin life over and get off this fucking merry-go-round that had me reeling. My boyfriend was almost finished with his last semester at university, and many of our friends would be graduating too. So they decided to rent a house in the Florida Keys for spring break, where we could all go for one last hurrah together. On the night before we left, I sat on my bedroom floor and made a handwritten list of every single intrusive thought I'd had in the nearly 9 months since my first. I told myself I would analyze each and every one to confirm they were indeed just thoughts and nothing more. And then I would cross them off that list and be done with them forever. It took me nearly 3 hours. But I was finally able to breathe, and I left for vacation the next day feeling like a new person. While we were in the Keys, my boyfriend proposed. 2 months later, I got a full-time salary job at a university. And 6 months after that, I was a married woman. My intrusive thoughts weren't gone, but I had started to open up about them. My husband, Pierce, knew what I was going through, but I still downplayed it, having become used to my new normal and understanding, at least on some level, that my OCD could be controlled by my compulsions. And this is how I spent the early years of our marriage. Loving our life together, making new friends, and continuing to create memories with the old, and finding purpose again. All the while carrying the secret that if I wasn't careful, my mind would almost certainly destroy me. With Pierce at my side, I felt less inclined to act on my compulsions because I could always look for him to reassure me. But in 2011, everything changed again. We had joined a church here in Atlanta, the same one we still attend today, and I had started grad school, published my first book, and just begun a new job as a full-time writer. This, it seemed, when our professional successes were growing and our faith and marriage were strong, was the perfect time for me to go on a service trip with members of our church to Kenya to help continue the construction of a local secondary school. I wrote letters and raised money, as many well-meaning white people have done before me, and a month before we left, I visited the health department for my required vaccinations. In October, I joined a group of 10 other people from our church and left for a 10-day trip to Africa. Immediately, I knew something was wrong with me. I couldn't sleep. The days were okay, but the nights were terrifying. I was having new kinds of intrusive thoughts, the violent kind. And I was stuck in a foreign country with a very sweet team and a very sweet roommate I had only just met who fell asleep soundly each night under her mosquito net while I sweated through my sheets with panic under mine. You see, I was afraid I was going to kill her. After 3 nights of barely any sleep, my exhausted body broke down and I went to our leader's room to ask for the international phone. She and the 3 other women who were rooming with her were sympathetic to my tears. They thought I just missed my husband, which was true, but not why I couldn't calm down. Still, I let them believe I was an emotionally insecure basket case because I couldn't bear to tell them the actual truth. That I gripped my pillowcase in terror every night to ground and convince myself that no, I wasn't getting out of bed and smothering my roommate in her sleep. No, I was lying right here, cozy in my cotton sheets, listening to Andy Stanley preach on my iPod. No, I wouldn't sleepwalk and commit homicide. Yes, the sun would rise and all would be well again. The morning would indeed come and I would sigh in relief and start the day happy and weightless. But by afternoon of each day, the clouds would roll in and I would begin to count the hours until bedtime. Until I'd have to face my demons once more. It was absolute hell, and I couldn't tell a soul. My journals from that trip are filled with desperate prayers for God to protect me and protect my team. Not from the potential harm of being in a country that at the time was seeing increased threats by terrorists, but from me. After only 3 nights of sleeping in my assigned room, I managed to convince our leader every night after that to let me sleep in hers with the larger group. Being alone triggered my thoughts, but having more people around shut them up and made me feel safer, more secure, less afraid. The Ambien they gave me once or twice didn't hurt either. I could sense them all quietly wondering what my deal was, which made me feel stupid, although they were too kind and compassionate to say anything about my odd behavior. But I was more than willing to sacrifice a bit of my pride to keep my sanity preserved. How I wish I would have told them what was happening, because come to find out, this was more than just my OCD. This was my OCD on mefloquin, a malaria medication I had been taking since a month before our departure. And as it turned out, this medication, which unbeknownst to me and many others had long been banned for use in the U.S. military, came with the lovely side effects that included hallucinations, night terrors, insomnia, and suicidal and homicidal ideation. I didn't find this out when I was prescribed the medication. It had been one of three options, the other two being doxycycline and Malarone, and I had chosen it for its ease of use. I had been the only one on our team who did. When we returned to Atlanta, after nearly 36 hours of constant travel, I burst into tears at the sight of my husband waiting in the airport. Again, everyone appeared to assume my tears were only for him, but when we got to the car and it was just the two of us, I began sobbing uncontrollably, the fear of what was happening in my brain raging at me, consuming me. Pierce rubbed my back and tried to offer consolation, but neither of us knew yet what was happening to my mind, and so the only thing we could do was go home. I went back to work and moved through my tasks like a zombie. I still couldn't sleep, and now my intrusive thoughts had switched from being about my roommate to about my husband. I hated falling asleep after he did, because then I'd be all alone with my thoughts. I tossed and turned, but held on tightly to his shirt while he slept, once again trying to ground myself in something physical as confirmation that I wasn't actually up grabbing a knife from the kitchen. Less than a week after our return, I went to bed early again and found myself wondering how I would ever, could ever, go on living like this. And then the solution came to me, and it was a lie from the devil himself. I didn't have to live like this. I could end it all right then. Like someone had punched me, I sat up in bed and screamed for Pierce. Again, I cried to the point of exhaustion, and the next morning, I got up to go to work as usual. I called my mother on the way there and told her everything, and she told me to get my ass to her doctor right that second. She would take care of my boss. All I needed to do was turn my car around. When the doctor heard my story, he demanded that the PA write me a prescription for doxy and that I cease taking mefloquin immediately. He knew exactly what was going on, and thank God for it. Within a week, I was almost entirely back to myself again, just in time for Thanksgiving. I look at photos from that time and think about how my smiling, happy self had considered suicide just weeks before. It was such a weird season. Despite feeling healthy again, I was saddened by what I saw as a huge loss. I had missed out on so much of our trip. It remains in my mind a pretty foggy experience, and I made sure to send the church a detailed email letting them know that mefloquin was a dangerous drug they should probably refrain from recommending in the future. They thanked me profusely and sent me a list of recommendations for counselors. The mefloquin was gone from my system quickly, but the medicine had triggered new types of thoughts that once I'd had, I couldn't seem to unhave. Now I had to learn to fight another kind of battle, because the bully in my brain had latched on with force, and she was not going to let go easily. A year later, in the fall of 2012, Pierce and I bought a house in the city. It was perfect, and we couldn't believe our luck. I had finished my novel and had some small success with it at a writer's conference, and was nearing the end of grad school. Again, on the outside, life was beautiful, and indeed it really was beautiful. And that's one of the things about having mental illness. It's largely unseen. It has to be experienced to be known. I contribute so much of my ability to thrive with my OCD to the strength of the community around me. Not everyone has this, and I wish they did. Because being alone is an enormous trigger for intrusive thoughts. I can't imagine trying to go through this without my people around me. Not only because they comfort and offer encouragement when times are difficult, but because they share their own hurts with me, and I realize that no one is immune to pain. Not even me, the woman who has spent her whole life trying to be good enough so that pain never comes her way. 2 months after we bought our house, just a week before Christmas, I was laid off from what had been a highly instructive but incredibly miserable job. The environment was hostile, and I never knew how long good days or good attitudes would last. It was like playing Russian roulette every morning when I walked in the door. I was not unhappy that I had lost my job there, and funnily enough, Pierce and I had gotten into a heated debate the night before about my quitting to go freelance, so that question had pretty much been answered for me. Some months prior to that, we had also decided that I would stop taking birth control, and we would give God the opportunity to bless us with a child if that's what He chose. I spent many an afternoon commute wrestling with God about whether or not I could trust Him with that choice. I like to ask lots of existential questions about the nature of His character, and by extension, my own, because I longed for a child, but I didn't think motherhood would go well with OCD. All I kept hearing from the Holy Spirit was, "I'm good." And that was my answer, and that was all I had to go on. In January of 2013, I had yet another terrifying episode with intrusive thoughts. Again, it was a new type of thought I hadn't yet endured. And again, it came after a season of time spent largely alone. I was working freelance, making very little money, but enjoying the flexibility of my days at home, while Pierce left each morning for his job with the Atlanta Falcons. I had been off birth control for almost 5 months at this point, and it was into this miserable existence, a time when I became so terrified of being alone that I would quite literally race out the door with Pierce each morning, and only come home when I knew he was there, that God looked at me and said, "Yep." The first words out of my mouth when I saw those two pink lines were, "Shit. Really, God? Now?" When I felt the least capable, God chose to bless me with a child. I should have known He would have different ideas for my life than I did for myself. Pregnancy in no way cured my intrusive thoughts, but the 10-month hormone surge did a lot to help me. Naturally, I was still frightened about how to live with OCD and still be a good mother, but I was overjoyed at the thought of being a parent. My own upbringing had been so good to me, and my heart was full of love to share. When our daughter Lucy was born that November, exactly a week before Thanksgiving, we were completely blissed out. But as any postpartum woman knows, the hormones that took 40 weeks to increase about 300% drop rapidly in just a few days after birth, leaving you feeling dangerously overwhelmed and emotionally spent. Mix that in with the paralyzing fear of intrusive thought OCD, and you have yourself a real winning combination. When Pierce left to go back to work for the first time, I sat on the couch watching him leave with huge, fearful eyes, holding a swaddled, sleeping Lucy to my chest. We didn't move from that spot until he got home. The first year of Lucy's life was easier than I expected, and also much harder. It wasn't the logistics of being a mother, all the new stuff you have to carry and be prepared for, the tiny little person who now demands your full attention at all hours of the day and night. None of those things shook me. It was the fear. It was the emotional toil of loving someone more than yourself, of feeling at once terrified that they'll get hurt and joyous at the prospect of getting a front row seat to this beautiful human's life. It was the knowing that any misstep on my part could end in disaster, and trying not to live as though my OCD was the ruling force in our lives. I finally started therapy years after I should have, when Lucy was 2 months old. As you might imagine, I cried during every session, but it was incredibly healing to tell my counselor all the terrible thoughts that had run through my mind, to share the awful, repetitive images that haunted my waking hours and threatened to steal all joy of motherhood, and see her do little more than nod or smile. She was, after all, the expert. Nothing I said was new to her. It was in her office that I learned about mindfulness and cognitive behavioral therapy, where I realized that my husband's advice over the past few months had been scarily counselor-like, and where I slowly began to confront my fears and finally overcome them. My OCD is not cured. I still fall victim to my compulsions from time to time, and I've had to accept the fact that while I still believe God can completely heal me, He might not. But I wouldn't take my story back. I wouldn't change it, even though I still wrestle with shame and doubt. OCD is the thing that taught my self-righteous heart to see past people's mistakes and look at the story behind them. It taught me that I have a story too, and that trying to avoid pain by always being perfect was never going to bring me the full and abundant life I was perpetually striving to maintain. It taught me compassion, and it taught me that joy on the other side of grief is the deepest joy there is, because it knows what can be lost, and it celebrates everything that still remains. Thanks again for listening to today's episode. I've included some of my favorite mental health links for you in the show notes, some of the things that have helped me cope with my OCD in healthy ways. So please take a look at those if you're interested. As always, you can find me on Instagram at SoOCDPodcast or on the website at SoOCDPodcast.com. I'll also link my personal accounts in the notes if you want to learn more about my writing and life. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes and leave a review so other people can find the show. See you next time.